I call the meeting of the House Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division to order. A quorum is present. Representative Luick, do you want to move the minutes?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
Representative Luick moves approval of the minutes for February 26th. Any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members and guests, we are going to continue today with the DNR budget presentation, followed by the Pollution Control Agency budget presentation. And I do want to note that the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency is here, so we want to make sure we get time there. And then it is our intent to move House File 340 out of the committee this afternoon. So with that, the DNR, Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, good afternoon. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, Assistant Commissioner. Thank you for letting us finish up our budget presentation today. As you know, we left off with the Division of Fish and Wildlife, so with us we have Acting Director Grant Wilson to go through their budget proposals.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wilson.
And members. My name is Grant Wilson. I'm the Acting Director of the Division of Fish and Wildlife, as Bob said. I've been with the DNR for 11 years and know some of you from my work previously with the department with Lasart Sands Outdoor Heritage Council and Outdoor Heritage Fund. Took over this week in an acting role for Jim Leach, who I believe was with you last week, and I think maybe you had the honor of being his last committee that he attended. So I'm really excited to be here in this role and excited to work with you in the near future. So the Division of Fish and Wildlife, yes?
One second, we're having a little bit of a
technical difference. Oh, okay. So Mr. Strohmeyer will be helping. And
sure.
I didn't touch anything.
It's good to be on.
There we go. Mr. Wilson.
And we're back. So the Division of Fish and Wildlife, I think as many of you know, we conserve, manage, and enhance habitat for Minnesota's fish and wildlife populations through regulation, restoration, monitoring, and education. So in addition to meeting the public trust of our natural resources management, the work we do benefits about 1.5 million anglers and about 600,000 hunters in the state and the economic contributions that they make to towns all across Minnesota. So the three components of the governor's budget recommendations I'm going to cover today. The first is addressing chronic wasting disease. And this is, I think, for reference on page 53 of your budget packets. And for references, also corresponds with Representative Becker Finn's bill, which is House File 850. So chronic wasting disease, or CWD, as this committee already knows, has been found in Houston, Fillmore, Crow Wing, and Winona counties. And now is a critical moment to protect the health of Minnesota's deer herd and secure our deer hunting tradition. An aggressive response is needed to contain CWD and eliminate it from the landscape where possible. To that end, the governor's budget includes $4.6 million in general fund and $1.8 million in game and fish fund to help keep CWD in Minnesota at low levels. This includes money for surveillance and response, including enforcement, landowner outreach, and USDA postseason removal in focused areas. The Game and Fish Fund portion includes research to better manage deer, specifically looking at better understanding of fawn survival and how deer use habitat on a finer scale. DNR has implemented its CWD response plan using Game and Fish Funds, which puts the burden on deer hunters for a larger problem, spurred in large part by surveillance around captive cervid farms. CWD is broader than a deer hunting issue. Given the potential impacts to local economies and potential human health impacts, and this initiative reduces our reliance on hunting licenses to address something that affects all Minnesotans. The next initiative is addressing dedicated deer license revenue. And again, for your reference, your budget packets, this is in page 77, I believe, and also corresponds to Representative Lee's bill, which is House File 600. So DNR has heard very clearly that our partners and stakeholders want a greater portion of deer license fees placed in the dedicated deer management account. And this initiative dedicates $16 per deer license to deer management activities within that deer management account. This is budget neutral and improves transparency in how we use deer hunting license dollars. Finally, I want to talk about angler surveys. So the governor's budget includes, and sorry, for reference, this is on page 73 of your budget packet. The governor's budget includes $810,000 from Game and Fish Fund to double the number of angler surveys we conduct each year. These surveys give fisheries managers critical information to track trends, monitor how well regulations are working, and improve information used in fish management decisions. We have very strong support from anglers to increase the number of surveys we do. They will help us improve fisheries management and fishing across the state. And with that, I'd stand for questions. Appreciate your time.
Any questions for Mr. Wilson? Did a great job.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment on the angler surveys. This is the exact information that we used up on Lake of the Woods and the Rainy River this past year, working with the stakeholders and residents up there to reevaluate the fishing pressure and reestablish some new regulations that were strongly that are strongly supported that will actually go into effect here in the next couple of weeks. This is an example of the importance of these types of projects.
I have a question about CWD. So the biannual budget change is in for the next biennium. So right now, and maybe either Mr. Wilson or Ms. Robeson or Commissioner, the money that you're spending right now, where's that coming from? What's in this current fiscal year, your response, and what happens? I'm assuming that's being pulled from somewhere. Where is it being pulled from, and is that being recovered?
Mr. Chairman, members, our current fiscal year activities, which run through the past hunting season and throughout up until June, are coming from the Game and Fish Fund. We have provided a memo to the committee previous in the beginning of session. It's about $1.3 million to date coming from the general fund. I mean, from the Game and Fish Fund. I'm sorry, this proposal would actually, as Mr. Wilson talked about, come from the general fund so that the burden is not placed on the deer hunters of the state of Minnesota. If you wish, I could provide that information again that outlines the loss opportunity that we've had within the Game and Fish Fund from spending those dollars, Mr. Chair.
I think we've got that on the website for the public. So, thanks, Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next, we'll bring up Colonel Rodman Smith, the Director of the Division of Enforcement.
Colonel Smith.
For the record, Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I only have two slides. Division of Enforcement, I think everybody kind of knows what we do, so is there interest in time? We do have one change item, and the change item for this year is to develop and maintain a comprehensive ice safety program. And so what I mean by a comprehensive ice safety program is right now we have very limited resources to do some very general broad outreach when it comes to ice safety, and it's mostly to traditional users. There's probably not a development that's being developed nowadays in this state where there's not a water retention pond. There's a lot of creeks. There's a lot of other water surfaces that freeze. We have new and immigrating communities coming into the state from tropical climates that don't have any idea about any ice and ice safety. We want to have targeted messaging to targeted communities to help people understand not only the safety aspects of ice, and this won't be a Mr. Yuck campaign where it's just danger, danger, danger. It's also about how people can connect to the outdoors by safely using and recreating on the ice. And so, for example, we partnered with Care 11 here not too long ago and did a very very, very good ice safety messages in the news. And actually, I was actually pretty proud of it. And then I heard from some folks that said, you know what, I saw that, and you'll never get me on the ice. And so there are segments of the community that looked at that and said, you know what, that scared me from going out on the ice. And so this program, we've talked to some people in the summertime that fish, and we asked them, well, you know, do you fish in the wintertime? And their lack of understanding, I guess, for better safety of ice and ice safety is a barrier for them to fish in the wintertime. And so this comprehensive ice safety program, again, will be something that's very targeted to different people in different communities. And that's all I have, and I stand for questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that brings us to the Division of Forestry with Director Forrest Bow to go review their budget initiatives.
Director Bow.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. Again, for the record, Forrest Bow, Director of Forestry with Minnesota DNR. Appreciate the opportunity to be here again this afternoon. I think most of you know about the Division of Forestry. I won't spend a lot of time going over activities, but as you also know, our main thing is to manage the state's timber resources, 4.2 million acres, 2.5 million acres of which is trust land. And we put out wildfires, we have forest health programs, we are dual certified from independent auditors, and it's all about planting trees, everything that we harvest. So we have two initiatives that I'd like to talk about today. The first one is on page 56 of your budget book, if you're following along there. Otherwise, I've got slides up. The first one is to meet our new sustainable timber harvest. This is a $2 million request for the biennium out of the Forest Management Investment Account. And last year, we established a new 10-year sustainable timber harvest target offer of 870,000 cords, plus a five-year initiative of an additional 30,000 cords for ash and tamarack, so that we can get ahead of those pest outbreaks in those two cover types. This proposal would fund additional foresters to meet that new timber target. Our second proposal is out of the Natural Resources Fund. We expect revenue to come in to cover this proposal.
Representative Wiginius has a question.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. When you're talking about sustainable timber harvest, tell us about how you're counting or looking at carbon sequestration, since this is something every one of us in the state has got to be working on this reduction of carbon. And are you tracking it? Do you have a plan for sequestration? Will you be having a plan?
Director Bow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiginius, you know, quite frankly, that is not one of the things that our Division of Forestry tracks in cubic tons, or you know, the normal way that we would track. A lot of research has been done on that. I would like to refer to, you know, the University of Minnesota folks as far as actual sequestration, how much is being sequestered by our state forests. What we've done with our sustainable timber harvest analysis is take a very detailed look at our inventory, what we have on the land, and actually projecting that out 100 years so that we are making sure we're not over-harvesting on any species over a very long period of time. And we, through that rigorous analysis, stakeholder input, we have determined a new sustainable timber harvest target.
Representative Wiginius.
Well, thank you. You bring up the second issue then. We've been told by, you referred to the University of Minnesota, by folks who've been working in this area, that if we don't move rapidly, and reducing our carbon, we will lose our boreal forests. So how is that? So I don't want to lose my first question, but how are you projecting out over 100 years? Are you including the loss of boreal forests and how you replenish them or keep them going, given the fact that we're on a trajectory that they're not sustainable, and certainly not for 100 years?
Director Bowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, in our model, we do have a climate change factor that is fed into the model. I can't tell you the exact particulars, but it's a certain percentage of change that will certainly happen over that period of time. And, of course, we're looking at a change in species. We're looking at change in cover types. So there is that built into the model.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you. I think we should know how what that factor is, because if it's not 100%, we don't have a clear picture of what the range of outcomes could be. You might have a smaller number, but you also have to have that bigger number, because we're talking about 2070, and that's way less than 100 years. So back to the first question, or I guess it's not a question anymore. It does seem that in forestry planning from now on, we have to be taking into consideration how much we are going to be using our forests for sequestration and the outcomes there. Because we have...
Director Bowe.
I'll move on to my final initiative. This initiative, again, is out of the Natural Resources Fund. The idea here is to expand our statute and responsibilities in Chapter 88 to include decorative materials. And so currently we have a buyer's license that's required for balsam boughs. We want to expand that to spruce tops and birch poles. Those two items have become very popular for weddings, for Christmas decorations, and we see a lot of illegal activity in the state. And by having this buyer's license, that the buyers would be responsible to track where those products came from, if the land was, or if the harvester had permission to be on that land, and then we would have again that tracking in order to ensure that those illegal harvest of spruce tops and birch poles was really kept at a minimum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Bowe, for being here. A couple quick questions. Your $870,000 target for sustainable timber, is that a 10-year target, or is there a chance of that growing over the 10-year period? Could you comment on that, please?
Director Bowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, it really is a 10-year target for what we think is sustainable over the next 10 years. As I mentioned earlier, we do try to look at a 100-year period, but really the focus is a 10-year plan. 10 years from now or 9 years from now, someone else gets to do that again. And they will have a new inventory to look at. They'll have more information, hopefully a lot more on carbon and a lot of other information as we get better about gathering information and managing forests.
President Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Bowe, then you mentioned the 30,000 cords of tamarack and ash. Is the DNR finding a market for tamarack and ash, or is the DNR doing their sales similar to what a lot of counties are, where they're including tamarack and ash in their sales to hit that quota just so they get rid of it?
Director Bowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, quite frankly, it's a little bit of both. We try to include some ash and tamarack. We want to get those species managed so that we can utilize those before they're dead and dying. Mills are starting to take more because they realize they can buy it cheaper and starting to include it in some of their mix. So that's a good thing so that we can get those lands managed and plant something on those sites except for that monoculture, something that will do good now and into the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
President Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Bull, you made a comment that I need to try to clarify here. You said that you needed to sell, I guess, for lack of a better word, permits for people to go into the state forest because they might be in that state forest illegally. Is that what you're telling me? So can you clarify that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, we sell a harvester's permit, and the harvesters are the ones that actually pick the product or harvest the product from the land. We do that by location, and that harvester can go in there. We give them specifications for what we want harvested. Many times, especially in a black spruce swamp, those trees come in too thick. And so we give that harvester a specification where you leave one good tree and you can take the ones within 5 feet around that so that that one good tree is able to grow and flourish. What we're proposing is a buyer's license. So the harvesters get a permit. They buy a permit from us. The buyers is how we track where that product has come from, not just on state land, but on county land or private land. And that's in many cases where we're seeing a lot of the illegal theft.
Representative Green.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So if someone wants to go on private land, what if they have permission from the landowner, can they go take those balls for free? Or do they have to still get the permit? Does the state then have to tell them you can't go on private land unless we tell you you can?
Director Bolt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, we only give a harvester's permit for harvesting on state land. If a private person wants to give someone a permission to go out there and harvest some of these on their land, that's up to them. I know the counties also have a harvester's permit. And again, what we're proposing is a buyer's license. So these are the folks that buy the product from the actual harvester. And that's how we are able to track where the product came from, whether the harvester had permission to harvest on that land, and track it essentially all the way across the country.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
I'll let the Deputy Commissioner go first.
I was just going to say that if you've bought in any of these at a local landscape nursery or Home Depot or something like that, the price for a bundle of 10 spruce tops, I think, is about $25 right now. So there is a substantial markup in this material, and we need to make sure that we have the ability to track chain of custody to ensure that it's coming from a legally sourced forest or that somebody's taking them from the right spot. We've had a couple instances where actually people have gone on school trust fund land and taken a lot of spruce tops illegally, and then we don't know where they come from because a spruce top is a spruce top. But a truckload of pickup truckload of spruce tops is a substantial amount of money, and we're trying to get it to reduce the theft and get our arms around this problem by being able to track that source of the material at the buyer's level. It's a small price for a permit. I think it's $25 we're proposing for this permit, and these people are making thousands and thousands of dollars off of the sales of these materials.
Representative Green.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know people that do the to make wreaths and stuff out of the boughs, and they don't really make that much because it's a limited time period when they do it, and they pay a lot of money for people to make them. But I won't belabor that too much. But the question I have is, I don't know if it's too much on state lands, but I see a lot of federal lands, and I'm going to try to make the comparison here, where we see a lot of dead and down trees, and I always hate to see that. You know, when we talk about carbon emissions, well, these dying trees emit a lot of carbon. Everything in the world is made up of carbon, and so if you die, you're going to be emitted into the air. So if you're going to take away all carbon, you better drop the bomb and let us all go. But on state lands, do you think that we're doing a good job managing our state forests as far as allowing permits to go in and harvest timber? Or do we have a lot of old growth down in our state forests as well?
Director Bowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I'm very confident that we manage state lands very appropriately and sustainably. We put a lot of effort into this last sustainable timber harvest analysis. Of course, all of that is based on an inventory of what we have on the ground. We frequently look at what I'll call age class scenarios and age class graphics. There is a lot of older timber on private and federal land, so much older age classes on those land types. The state land has a very even age class, which means that we manage it quite well.
I'm glad to hear that. And do you have any, and this will be my last question for this testifier, but do you have any studies or reports that show just how long forests can remain before they become a detriment instead of an asset, if you understand what I'm talking about?
Director Bowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I know exactly what you're talking about. We do have those studies, those reports, and essentially it's right down to the tree species. So we know how long a particular species lasts, how long it's vigorous, and after that it declines. And I'd be able to share that with you by species of tree if you wish.
Any other questions? Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I forgot this earlier, Director Bowe. A couple years ago, we appropriated money for the private forest management plan. I don't expect you to have the answer here today, but could you get it to me on how successful that is and maybe a number of cords that we're generating off private land sales?
Director Bowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, I do have a couple of things with me on that if you want to. In 2018, as you know, a couple of years ago, we did reinvigorate the PFM program, Private Forest Management Program, and we also created a new cost share program along with that. We, just in 2018, resulted in almost 700 new stewardship plans, and those are a plan that a landowner has. They've met with a forester, sometimes a consulting forester. Now we have a plan for what to do on that piece of private land. In many cases, that means planting trees. So also last year, there was almost 600,000 seedlings planted on that private land. And we did what we'll call, we call them assists. So when we assist someone, they do a project. And that could be a erosion control project, could be an invasive species project, or a timber sale. Many of those timber sales I actually referred to the consultants, that's their bread and butter, and so I don't have a cordage per se coming off those private lands, but certainly a very significant number of assists.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Bowe.
Mr. Chairman, seeing no further questions, we'll move into the Lands and Minerals Division with Acting Director Susan Damon.
Ms. Damon, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Susan Damon. I'm currently the acting director of the Division of Lands and Minerals. I've been acting director for just a few weeks. You probably know that our former division director, Jess Richards, is now an assistant commissioner. And my normal capacity at the DNR is as assistant director of the Division of Lands and Minerals, focusing on lands. So just a very brief overview of the Division of Lands and Minerals. Staff in our division are the DNR's real estate experts. We acquire, sell, and exchange land. Our management of the DNR's real estate portfolio includes issuing leases, licenses, and easements for the use of state land, We're also the division that uses the DNR's land record system to calculate the annual payment in lieu of taxes, which is distributed to counties, townships, and school districts. The division employs geologists, mining engineers, reclamation specialists, hydrologists, and research scientists who work on minerals matters. We operate a world-class drill core library out of our Hibbing facility. And the division is also responsible, along with the Division of Ecological and Water Resources and the Pollution Control Agency, for regulating mining in Minnesota. Our division administers water appropriation permits, public water work permits, and permits to mine. And finally, our division operates the state's mineral leasing program. The total revenues in the past 10 years from leases of state minerals has been about $357 million. The primary beneficiaries of these revenues are the Permanent School Fund, the Permanent University Fund, counties, townships, and cities and school districts where tax forfeited minerals are leased. The division has a very small proposal in the governor's budget, and this proposal actually consists of the portions of the DNR lands bill that have fiscal impacts. There are five land sales that would be authorized that are expected to bring in some revenues into the land acquisition account. And there is also a proposal to eliminate a requirement that we publish land sales in local newspapers. We have other very effective means of advertising our sales, including through the DNR's website. We have a gov delivery service that has over 35,000 subscribers, and we also send letters to landowners who own property adjacent to the parcels that are up for sale. And last year at our land sale, there were 16 parcels of land that were sold at public auction. 12 of those 16, I believe, were two adjacent landowners. So these seem to be the most effective methods of advertising. That provision is expected to reduce our costs by a small amount. So with that, I would be happy to answer questions.
Any questions? Representative Green.
Thank you. Just a quick one. It's going to be redundant because I probably say it every year, that I don't know if we're quite there yet on the elimination of newspapers. I know that here in the metro, you guys don't really rely on them as much, but in our area, we rely on them quite a bit. And I think that there's still a lot of people out there, whether it be because we don't have as much broadband or just they just don't have computers or don't search these sites. And so I would really, and especially if it's just going to be a small savings, I would personally rather see you do that at least for a few more years until we get over the kind of the hump of people not having access to the computers.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Green. I appreciate that comment.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, to that note, perhaps when we get to that section of the lands bill, we could make it permissive rather than say shall use may. That would allow us to use those rural newspapers. Yeah. But in cases of the metropolitan area where most of our customers are electronic, they're getting our gov delivery, getting other methods that we have out there. I certainly recognize the point you bring up, but to have that requirement statewide I think is a little bit onerous. One of the opportunities we're looking at is reinvesting these savings into other opportunities, such as publishing land sales in the New York Times or doing some national promotion, because there are a lot of people out there looking for recreational land in Minnesota. So I understand your concern completely, and we'll work with you on trying to figure out a path forward on that.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And ladies and gentlemen, it'll be of no surprise to you that one of these issues that you're overseeing is maybe the most sensitive issue that I faced during the campaign, and that is the issue of mining and the role that DNR plays. And I hope I have friends around the table here who respect the sensitive situation that I look forward to participating in. But it seemed to me that DNR is responsible for both promoting the mining industry and protecting the land. And as representatives from your office stopped by my office, we talked a little bit about that. But it is an issue which kind of concerns me. It seems to me that it's difficult to promote and at the same time protect against overuse or misuse of land resources. Can you comment on that, or would you just like to postpone the conversation? We can talk about it in private.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can say that I believe we have a very good division of staff who focus on one area and another, and where there is overlap, we have expertise. Some of our geologists, for example, who work primarily on promotion, have expertise that helps with our mineral leasing and with our permitting area. But I would be happy to meet with you privately and provide you some additional information.
Great, Mr. Chair. Does the expertise come from a outside counsel, or do you use the Attorney General's office for all of that information?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, we have staff attorneys at the DNR. We also have a general counsel's office at the DNR. We also work closely with the Attorney General's office. We do hire outside counsel in specific litigation matters or potential litigation matters. So it really is a combination. Our in-house attorneys are experts in typically mineral leasing, and they also have some expertise in mine permitting. But we also consult with the Attorney General's office and have their representation in numerous matters.
Thank you. I would like to pursue the issue of outside counsel a little bit later on with you. I just want to make sure that outside counsel isn't used to both establish permits and then defend those permits.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if there's no other questions, we'll move on to Operations Service Division with Lori Martinson, the director.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Lori Martinson. I'm the director of the Operations Services Division. My division is responsible for human resources, safety, engineering, fleet, all the things that help support the operations of the agency. I have one budget initiative to talk to you about today, and that's our DNR, protecting DNR IT applications. This is on page 58 of your budget books. We have approximately 170 applications at the DNR. Many of them have data on, not public data on individuals, and other not public data, or data on minors. That's public. We have lots of data on people. We have lots of data. And so what we're asking for here is an investment up front to help us keep those applications current, patched, working correctly, that we have got good infrastructure, and also to pursue some cloud strategies that will help us really make sure that data is secure and for the future. We're pretty proud of what we do to date, but we don't think we can keep pace without this additional support and help from you. And I think I'll close.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That leaves us with several three more initiatives that Ms. Robeson and I will be discussing. So Ms. Mary will cover the first two, and then I will take the last one.
Ms. Robeson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Mary Robeson, Chief Financial Officer at the DNR. I'm here first to present the operating adjustment that is included in the governor's budget, and you'll find this on pages 45 and 46 of your book. The total amount in this request for 2021 is $15.9 million. That is distributed across our funds at the DNR, such that the general fund portion is $4.8 million for the biennium, and 11.1 is spread throughout the remainder of our funds. I'll talk about this in two major components. One is for compensation growth under the current contracts. That's $13.7 million of the total. Again, this is to cover obligations under current contracts and known growth and compensation over the biennium. The other portion is $2.2 million for the biennium for a minute cost increases due to the proposed rates in fiscal 20. And with that, I'll take any questions on that. Okay.
Ms. Robeson, just a question. So that is under the current contracts, not for any future contracts.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The next initiative is just over $6 million for the biennium for legal costs. This is a one-time general fund ask in 20 and 21. The DNR and the PCA both have regulatory permitting and leasing decisions that face legal challenges. Of course, the right to appeal is an important part of our legal process and due process for the state's decisions. At the same time, defending these complicated cases takes resources. This particular ask would cover the Attorney General representation for major litigation, as well as outside counsel, and one staff attorney located at the DNR to assist in major litigation. Please note that 1.6 of this $6 million would transfer over to MPCA to help with their projected legal costs for the biennium as well.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the operating adjustment page. Thank you. Of the $13.7 million, and then explain to me, and I try to get my arms around this frequently, how do we, as a state of Minnesota, pay employees that work for, in this case, the Department of Natural Resources, and where does that money come from in the state budget?
Ms. Robinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I can speak for the Department of Natural Resources. Again, the allocation of compensation across the DNR is reflected in the operating adjustment page if you want to look at the different funding sources. And it is spread, again, based on where our staff sit in the organization based on the work that they do. So we allocate that cost out and across the funds according to the appropriate use of each funding source. In terms of the amount, we obviously have things like step increases in our current contracts, as well as existing pension obligations that have already been agreed to that we need to then project out and understand. In this particular operating adjustment, it comes to about 2% a year total in terms of compensation cost. Again, this doesn't include any cost of living adjustment that would be in future contracts.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I want to try to be more clear on in my mind is, and I hear what you're saying, I get all of that, mm-hmm. but one of the things that concerns me about the way money is moved, I'll say, within the agency, when enforcement goes out to do ATV or they're on Lake of the Woods checking, it's my understanding that enforcement then sends a bill to the Game and Fish Fund or the ATV account or the snowmobile account, but we don't backfill that with our operating adjustments, so those accounts take the hit. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, our goal is that that would not be correct and that the operating adjustment would be distributed by the agency according to the way that the work is done, such that it is asked for and given how the work is being conducted. I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
I think, Assistant Commissioner Meyer, we've had this conversation, and it really becomes confusing for a lot of people as to how we are actually paying an employee's salary when they're going from one division to the next. And a lot of people just think that we appropriate money through the state budget, state gov finance, you know, operating adjustments, whatever, but yet we're billing different divisions within the agency, and then we're taking money from the Game and Fish Fund that's come from the folks' hunting licenses, but we're paying conservation officers out of there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, maybe I can provide a little clarity to that using the enforcement example. So the Division of Enforcement has an eight-way split on their funding sources based upon general fund, water rec, ATV, whatever the work that they're doing. When they do their timesheet, they code out 3 hours on ATV, as on Lake of the Woods on an ATV, 3 hours as a snowmobile. That would be a split between snowmobile and Game and Fish Fund. So there's that fund integrity that ties directly to their work. This appropriation increase not only has, as Ms. Robinson said, the general fund piece, it also goes into those dedicated accounts seeking additional funds to fund that increased salary compensation. So we aren't charging a bill per se. We're billing directly to those accounts. And it's all about fund integrity. We may have to make sure that it's an allowable source. So particularly in the conservation officer example, their work has to be directly tied to snowmobiling or ATVing. The problem we have there is when their general fund appropriation, which is very small compared to everything else, and that's fire, Wetland Conservation Act, things that we don't have accounts for get coded to the general fund. So we have to make sure that there's money there as well. So the snowmobilers aren't paying for our conservation officers doing Wetland Conservation Act enforcement and things like that. So everything is tied back to the account. What this appropriation would do would be to increase the amount that we can spend out of those accounts. So you are right, the snowmobiles are paying a little bit more because our staff costs increase. Does that help you at all?
Mr. Chair, I'll talk offline with them again. I know you're very busy today, but
we'll get,
yep, thank you. But I think it's important for the new members of the committee to understand that it's not quite as here's money in an account and we write out an employee's check and it's all done.
Mr. Chair, just really quickly, it's important to note in previous bienniums, years ago, when there was an operation increase or a salary increase, typically there was an appropriation, many times just a general fund appropriation, given by the legislature for the executive branch to cover those increased costs. We have kind of gone away from that now, and instead we come back after the fact, ask for those increased appropriations. Otherwise, we have to manage through vacancies or attritions where there's a position open we won't fill up, but use those salary savings to fund those salary increases. So there's kind of a yin and a yang to that, but we will definitely get something set up to follow up with that. Mr. Chairman, the last one that we have is a relatively simple one. Many of you are very familiar with the Office of School Trust Fund, Office of School Trust Lands. Their budget in past bienniums has been carried in the state government finance bill. Director Van de Linde and I sat down and spoke about some of the barriers that are there right now. So what happens is the money is appropriated to the Department of Administration. He has to then request the Department of Administration transfer the money to the DNR because we're his fiscal agent. He has to pay us for services such as rent, phones, things like that. This will eliminate that one step, thereby creating a little bit of efficiencies in his budget, reducing some of the time and the cost necessary to transfer that money. So it's a budget neutral issue supported by both the Office of School Trust Lands, the DNR, and Vice Chairman Lewick of the Permanent School Trust Fund Commission, I believe, supports this as well. So the commission, we've discussed it with them earlier this week.
Commissioner. Representative Sandell has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm an example of what Representative Fabian suggests as a first-year person who's a little confused about some of the money here. As I heard your testimony, I thought I heard you say that there was $6 million in legal fees that is being appropriate this year, and 1.6 was going to DNR. On page 48 of the booklet here, it talks about legal support, and it says the majority of the funding would go to the General Attorney's Office the Attorney General's Office and contracted legal support. I wonder what the breakdown is. Is most of it going to the Attorney General's Office, or is it most of it going to contracted legal support?
Yes.
Ms. Robeson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I want to be clear that 1.6 of the $6 million is transferring to MPCA. The first one. So the majority is actually spent at the DNR or for the DNR. Mm-hmm. In terms of your question about the allocation of the funding across the different pieces, this request includes $500,000 a year for the Attorney General. So of the total, $1 million would be estimated to go to the Attorney General. And then there's one staff position that would be supported in here at the DNR for in-house counsel, and the remainder is for outside counsel.
Which would be about what? Which would be about what amount?
Mr. Chair, Representative, for the DNR, it would be $3.2 million, and for the MPCA, it would be the 1.6.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sandell.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly on the legal cost appropriation, it's important to note this isn't all mining related. We're spent over $1 million to date on the White Bear Lake lawsuit. It's also incurring large costs on the Fargo-Moorhead diversion issue. The DNR is a an attorney's dream to sue us, right? So we get a lot of lawsuits coming in. And why, for the example of White Bear Lake, why should that money come out of the Ecological and Water Resources budget, which is general fund? Because we couldn't use any dedicated accounts, we have to seek an appropriation from the legislature to pay for those types of things.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I noted on page 48, the first full paragraph, we talked about it talks about providing special appropriations for these large and unexpected legal costs. And I think to that, part of that has to be trying to prevent ourselves from getting into situations where we're going to have those legal costs. You know, if we know that it's something involving the Constitution or treaty rights, those things are kind of notoriously going to probably have to, they're not, it's not small claims court. You know, it's something that's going to continue to go on and likely be expensive. And I think to that, that gets back to the money that's being spent on chronic wasting disease. And so I think that that's really important that that's included, because managing the disease better will hopefully prevent future lawsuits as we look at the constitutional right to hunt and the different treaties that might be impacted, especially now that we're closer to those treaty areas with Crow Wing County. So just kind of wanted to point that out, that it's it'd be better if we could avoid these unexpected legal costs, because some of them maybe could be expected and avoided. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor. Thank you so much. And that is our first goal, right, to avoid litigation at all costs. And I think it's also important to note, back in the 80s, this is not unprecedented. Back in the 80s, when the state was suing North Shore Mining, they used outside counsel as well. There was appropriation that was given to agencies to hire outside counsel to sue the company there as well. So it's not unprecedented to do this type of activity.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the budget overview, but I just wish that we would have had the House budget overview instead of the Senate.
I apologize for that. Well, you know what? We have made a few more copies today. We might have gotten them mixed up. I apologize.
Taking more trees.
Well, thank you. I think we're going to move to the pollution control.
Thank you very much. We look forward to working with you in the coming weeks and months to finalize this budget.
Oh, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just got an email across in the last couple of days in regards to the Minnesota Conservation Volunteer publication. If you don't get that, members of the committee and public, if you don't get that, you really should look into that. There's so much information that I've gathered from that. That has prepared me for some of this testimony, and it's just a great publication that I willingly sponsor every year or so. Please look into that.
Thank you very much.
Pollution Control Agency, and we have the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency here.
I know what. I see.
Here it is. We got it.
Commissioner Bishop, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Or good afternoon. It all blends together, doesn't it?
It does.
So, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Laura Bishop, the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. I will kick this off and turn it over to our team to walk through a number of the budget items explicitly, but wanted to, because I do need to leave for another meeting, but wanted to walk through our initial introduction and then leave it open for some questions that you might have for me before I need to depart. So the Pollution Control Agency, and really this is for many of the newer members of the committee, our mission is to protect and improve the environment and human health. The key priorities that I will be focusing on and have kind of designated during the, first few weeks of that I've been on the job, really for me, for the agency, are efficiency and due diligence, and this really goes to our permitting processes. I hear from a number of folks that sometimes our permits are taking longer than expected. I hear from others that we're doing them too quickly. So really looking at the process and adding transparency to the process is something that I'm interested in evaluating and providing to you and to the public. Stakeholder engagement and communication is another key priority for me. We do a lot of this, but we can do more. And so it's been something that I want to look at and how we do this stakeholder engagement and getting out into the communities and being more engaged in the communities around the state. And then finally, looking at ways that we can coordinate across agencies to coordinate a statewide effort to address climate change. The MPCA has a organizational structure where we have six regional offices: Duluth, Detroit Lakes, Brainerd, Marshall, Mankato, and Rochester. We also, we were established, and back to that slide, two-thirds of the staff are located here in St. Paul, but a third of the staff are in our regional offices. I'm making the rounds to the regional offices, many of them after session, but I was in Duluth this past week. So we were established in 1967 as MPCA, a medium-sized agency, about 900 FTEs, relatively low turnover rate of 2.5%. One of the things that I've been interested in is, certainly we have retirees that in the next 5 years, 30% of our workforce will be of retirement age, and so that's been a concern. So the low turnover rate now, we would expect that it would be increasing. One of the things that I'm encouraged by is that we do have a real influx of young people that are coming into MPCA, especially in our air permitting division. So I have been working with the agency and really looking at how we retain and those people that are coming into the agency now, and that's a major effort on our part. 48% of our agency is women, and 70% of our staff are scientists. The MPCA's statutory authority, there are 229 state laws that apply to the MPCA and direct program operations. In addition, we have the delegated authority for many federal laws, including our air programs, our water programs, and our land programs through the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and our Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. With our organizational structure, we have seven different divisions, eight including the Commissioner's Office, our Remediation Division, our Watershed Division, Operations, Environmental Analysis and Outcomes, Resource Management and Assistance, Industrial Division, and Municipal Division. We can go through those in more specifics as we go through our budget process as well. So for the budget, with Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's budget, they focused on three different areas: education, healthcare, and community prosperity. The PCA recommendations fall squarely in the community prosperity area, and we'll be talking more about those. I will also say that as our budget is presented, you should see a common theme of what I've talked about with the other three priorities that I'm looking at for our agency as well, the efficiency stakeholder and looking at the continued work on climate. So with that, we will get into some of the budget recommendations, and I will ask our Chief Financial Officer and Assistant Commissioners to come in up as they talk about those. But before I do that, Mr. Chair, if the committee has questions for me, I'd be happy to answer those.
Yeah, and members and members of the audience, I think what we'll do is do a question and answer with the commissioner, and then with timeliness, we may need to break, and then we're going to take up the bill, and then they want to plan for later for the rest of the bill or for the so it just depends on the time, but I would stay here just in case we'll have a series of questions, I'm sure, for the commissioner. So, Representative Greenwood.
If you want to break and come back for this, I can wait.
Well, the commissioner's only going to be here for right now.
So. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one, and it's pretty simple. You said you got about 900 employees. Can you tell me how much the MPC has grown, say, over the last 10 years? What was your number of employees 10 years ago?
So I will... Mr. Chair, Representative Green, Joshua, our Bunker, our Chief Financial Officer, would be able to answer that question more specifically. My 6 weeks on the job, I'm not quite sure on the 10 years.
Mr. Bunker.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Joshua Bunker. I serve as the Chief Financial Officer for the Pollution Control Agency. Over the last 10 years, our agency has grown from an FTE count in 2012 of 876 FTE to our present projection within the governor's recommendation of 912 total. We had a peak number of FTEs in 2015 of 951, but we have come down from that point now, projecting about 30 short of that in for fiscal year 2021.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to the committee. It's nice to see you. We heard, Commissioner Bishop, we heard last night in the Environment Committee, Policy Committee, a proposal that would bring back the Citizens Board. Can you give me any insight on your thoughts of that? I heard that the MPC was neutral on it, but just give me some enlightenment from your perspective.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian. I've been asking staff as well as outside groups about the Citizens Board when it existed at MPCA. What I will say is it does provide an avenue for citizens to engage with the MPCA, and that's positive. I also am chairing the EQB, which has citizen advisory board members, and I see that as a good conduit for citizen engagement. At this point, we are neutral on the Citizens Advisory Board, or Citizens Board. There are some things that I'm looking at with it in the proposal, and I've talked to Representative Purcell about some initial questions that I had about the decision-making authority and how that is impacted with the engagement and decisions and timelines of decision-making for the commissioner, but at this moment we are neutral. What I can say is citizen engagement is a priority for me. We have an environmental justice advisory group. There is a current advisory board to the agency and to the commissioner, as well as you'll see in our budget recommendations that there is a stakeholder outreach and engagement effort as well. So with that, my answer is that I'm neutral on the bill itself, yet very much welcome the engagement of citizens in our work.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. And as the process moves forward, I'd appreciate the conversation with you too sometime about why I supported what happened in 2015. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Fisher and then Representative Lee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Commissioner. It's good to see you here today. My question is around the area of long-term figuring out how we approach enforcement and following up on permits. There have been a number of instances that have come up lately And I found another one that's come up in the evidently in the last couple of years of a continuing violation. First of all, of a smelter dealing with lead in the Eagan area that's been violating the permits. I know one of my fellow representatives will probably hit one in their district, but I'm also hitting a little bit on Water Gremlin. You know, this was a violation where we were on a thing of self-reporting. And this is a violation now that appears to go, we know it at least to 2009, might go back to 2002. And we've always been more on kind of an inspection type thing instead of an audit and really looking at a deep ability to see what's happening in violations. For those that are not aware, the Water Gremlin one not only does it go back that far, is that the releases of the contaminant that's a cancer-causing agent, the releases were up to 100 times higher than what is allowed by law. And this has been going on for many, many years. And trying to figure out that sometimes it may be something as simple as human error that might occur in the process. So what are we doing, and what do we need from the agency to be a little bit more proactive in terms of monitoring, inspections, not just inspections, but auditing what's going on? What kind of philosophy change are we going to see in this kind of area?
Yeah.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fisher, thank you for that question. It is a concern for me. Only within, you know, 4 days of starting, I was... Water Gremlin was a issue that landed kind of on my lap, and yes, it is very concerning. I have Jeff Smith here from our industrial division. He can talk about some of the enforcement, yet what I will say is he knows that I've been talking to them quite a bit as well. He can walk through how the self-reporting works and why. What I will say is that when companies are using a chemical like TCE, which is hazardous, that we need to be doing more inspections and more work in this area to ensure that we're monitoring and that there's compliance with the permits. There's about 70 companies within Minnesota that use this solvent in their processes, as we found out, and that will be something that we'll be working to have on a audit and different enforcement as well as inspections, and something that we're talking, I want to talk with you more about it, but something that I am very concerned about.
If we could, mm-hmm. I want to just get the questions on the record so that when we come back later, whenever that is, we can have the enforcement response. So I know... If that's okay with Representative Fisher, we'll go over that. Representative Fisher.
Oh, and just one real quick thing is because this is an area that not a lot has been done in the past, the other question that comes in, are there additional resources that are going to be needed, and is that part of the request or not, and how that's all going to be for future here?
Representative Lee and then Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for coming before the committee. And my line of questioning is similar to what Representative Fisher said, and, you know, there are some heavy industry sites in my district that, you know, a lot of my constituents are concerned about, and I'm really glad to hear you say that, you know, one of the focuses is to see how could we have community engagement, and you really have that as part of the process. And so I just wanted to ask maybe yourself or one of your staff if you could just tell us a little bit more of the governor's budget. How much of the budget is geared toward enforcement action?
Yeah. Mr. Chair. So, and Representative Lee, I don't have a number right now on how much is geared toward enforcement action, and certainly our CFO can provide that's part of our base budget. There is not in the budget requests that we are putting forward for new budget items. There is not something in there for additional enforcement. What I can say is that this is an ongoing dialogue because it wasn't until January 11th that I got the became aware of the Water Gremlin issue, which has now raised my concern on some of these issues. What I will say is, you know, most companies are doing the right thing. And we see that, and we know that. Yet when a company has a violation or is not in where human health is at risk, we should be very concerned, and I know all of us are, and so we want to look into this more carefully and know that that's a priority for me.
Mr. Chair.
Griffin Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have an article here, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, if I could get the pages to pass to the members of the committee and also for the public, too. And I have shared one of the copies with Greta from the NPCA, and this is regarding an article that I saw from NPR last night with the title saying, Report EPA Fails to Enforce Major Pollution Crime, including two incidents in Minnesota. And so, Commissioner, if you can answer this, maybe one of your staff later on, could you just tell us what is the relationship between the state PCA and the federal EPA when it comes to enforcement action? And here in the article that members will see stated two really serious incidents here in the state that have not seen any enforcement action. And the article state that one of the reasons why is because of the lack of funding coming at the federal to the EPA. And so just wanted to figure out what is the relationship and what can we do at the state level to bridge that gap if the EPA is not going to enforce some of these standards.
If I can just, what I'm going to do is kind of line up the three questions, so if that's okay. And then Representative Wagenius and then Representative Heinzman, if you could each ask your questions so we can get them on the record. Representative Wagenius and then Representative Heinzman. I'm going to have each of you ask your question because we're running out of time, and then we'll.
Well, mine has to do with. Oftentimes I've heard the PCA say to us, well, we have to wait until EPA does that. And in this day and age, when President Trump is working to make sure EPA doesn't do anything and actually goes backwards, will we be continuing to hear from your agency that we won't do anything until EPA acts?
And then Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was really thankful for the opportunity. You came to my office a number of weeks ago, and I just want to thank you so much for spending the time with members. I know you made a number of visits, and it was really nice to have that opportunity, and I'm thankful for that. My question would be along the lines of the agency's practices and going back quite a ways. I'd just like to know, as someone coming into the agency, I don't expect there to be a major departure from science, but in terms of just the way we do things, is there going to be a fresh approach to some extent you could discuss? Hopefully we're looking at sort of the big picture and processes that maybe could be streamlined or maybe could be discussed. We've talked about a number of businesses that are in communities across the state, my community as well. And while I'm hearing some discussion around difficulties that are being faced in some places, I'm also trying to find ways to see jobs come into my community or at least stay in my community.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, so I'll try to address all three of these. The first two questions were really about EPA enforcement and EPA oversight and engagement with the PCA. First on the EPA enforcement, what I can say is, and just EPA in general, is that, you know, within my first week, even though EPA was shut down, I did get a email message from the Region 5 administrator indicating that while they were shut down, they would provide, you know, some of the services that they could to us, and that she was eager to meet with me, and she has arranged a meeting to come here to meet with me, and I take that as a positive sign about the relationship with EPA. The enforcement piece, there are different levels of enforcement that EPA does and that our agency does, and I would like my staff to follow up, because when I did get this question, when I got your article, I asked the same thing. Did the state MPCA act on any of these, and what is the difference between EPA actions and oversights and our actions. So that will be something that I will be following up directly with you and members of the committee to address Representative Lee, because certainly when things come up like this that they say the EPA didn't act, I want to know, was there a violation that the state acted on, or and what was the background on these types of matters? So that will be something that I will be following up on. Representative Wagenius, to your question, I will, since we are governed by many of the federal laws, I would prefer that the answer back is not, you know, we have to wait on the EPA. Yet I will ask my staff and the agency a lot more about that. You know, when can we make decisions if we are not getting the response from the EPA, a response from the EPA? You know, certainly that's something that I'll be asking. There are a number of different areas where the EPA is providing input and useful input on matters and rulemakings and other pieces that we're seeing, but I don't know on the gaps, and that will be something that I'll be following up with, and I'd like to get back to you. And Representative Heitzman, so agency practices, that is, you know, my first priority really outlined was this efficiency and due diligence. And what I will say is that I, one of the first things I did was go to the Minnesota Chambers dinner, but also annual legislative dinner, but also to the Environmental Policy Committee. And I met with a lot of the members of the committee and asked them, when you're a business that's doing business with the MPCA, what is that process like? And I also asked, and I know Tony Quiles was here, is here, but I also asked them if we could set up a roundtable, and just so that I can understand from that practice of when they start with an idea of a business, what happens during that process, and when do they come to the PCA, what are those interactions like? That's not something that I'm familiar with, and I want to become more familiar with so that I can understand those processes. I also have noticed that there's a gap between what some say it takes, you know, 18 months to get a permit through the MPCA, when my team will say, no, it really does take, you know, 6 months for a permit to go through. So there is some gaps in what perception is and what I'm hearing from our teams at MPCA, and I'd like to understand exactly that, what is in between in those gaps and what's happening with that narrative. So it is something that I'm looking into, and the processes piece on the permitting is definitely something that is top of mind and a top priority for me. In addition, with that, you know, we've talked a little bit about the enforcement. That's another piece, that when we have these processes on permits, we will be looking at our processes on enforcement. I've also heard that when there is an enforcement, that you have a caseworker that works with you throughout the whole time of the enforcement action. But when you're getting a permit, there isn't that same caseworker. So how can we find those same resources that allow for those processes to go forward? So it's something that I'm evaluating, and definitely you have my commitment that it will be something I'll be looking at, and jobs are a top priority. We all know that we need more jobs and more people to fill those jobs here in the state. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And I think we will now have Representative Lilly. So thank you. I think we'll proceed to the bill. Members, the next bill we have up for consideration today is House File 340. It was referred to this division by the Ways and Means Committee. We heard testimony on the bill on Thursday, February 5th, 2019. I move that House File 340 be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommended referral to the Legacy Finance Division. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I was a little mad that you made me wait at first, but that actually was really very, very interesting. So you have the bill before you, and I see that there's some amendments. I don't know where you want to go. We can backtrack and go through the whole bill again if you like. But I look to the chair's direction.
I know you're smiling, Representative Lilly. I think there were a couple questions from members. If we just take, is there any questions from members following up from last? We'll proceed to the amendments then. And I assume there may be some testimony on the amendments. So I want to take the A3 amendment first. Members, these are both my amendments. So the A3 amendment is amending nothing in the bill, but it is adding the section of statute. It's changing the section of statute that essentially expired in 2014. And it updates it to the current nomenclature. So it says the House and Senate chairs of the committees and divisions with jurisdiction over environment, natural resources, finance, and the Outdoor Heritage Fund must convene a joint hearing to review the activities and evaluate the effectiveness of the council and to review reports on the council from the legislative auditor no later than June 30th, 2020. So that was originally done in 2014. And I believe, Representative Wagenius, that was you and Representative Senator Anderson actually did one of those before 2014, if I remember. So, okay. Representative Lilly, any questions, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to your amendment, we've had a brief opportunity to look at it, and Mr. Johnson may have some comments, but my understanding is that this was done before. It's just kind of redoing it. It doesn't seem overly problematic, but I think it certainly having some peek at things again is healthy for all of us. So I'm just going to pass to Mr. Johnson and let him roll with.
Mr. Chair, all I can add to that is I spoke with the chair of the Outdoor Heritage Council today, and he said it looks like good government, so he has no opposition.
Any questions? I would move the A3 amendment. Any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Amendment is adopted. The A2 amendment. I would move the A2 amendment to get it in front of us. And members, this is following up from a discussion we had about a month ago, and it's relating to the Conservation Partners Legacy Program. And if you would take a look on pages 19, 20, and 21. Ooh. What it does is removes the cap on grants to the 7-county metropolitan area with cities with a population of 50,000 or more. It, on page 20, deletes the provision that says land acquired a fee must be open to hunting and fishing during the open season unless otherwise provided in law, and then also deletes the provision that it must be within 1 mile of wildlife management areas under the statute. So those changes are only within the Conservation Partners Legacy Program, and I think the purpose for the amendment is following up on the discussion that we had, that there has been a de facto impact of exclusion of metropolitan areas by assigning a statutory and a session law requirement that land must be open for hunting and fishing. And so removing the 3 million cap allows that entire 11 million, so the best projects, wherever they are, would be picked, and they wouldn't have to have hunting and fishing if it's acquired. And they wouldn't have to be next to one, within 1 mile of a WMA. And I think that discussion occurred back on February 5th. Representative Becker Finn and Representative Wagenius are talking a bit about that. Any discussion, Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this amendment, there's quite a bit of moving pieces. So there's, I think some are, I'm not sure this one will work out exactly as you planned. I think, so I'd like to start with like the CPL kind of limit. I think you meant to have more access in the metro, but I think what happens right now is that $3 million, right now, the first $3 million goes to the metro, and then what happens, the metro actually has access to the other additional grants. So what, and I think we had about $2.7 million of requests for that first. So I'm not sure that, you know, that's going to accomplish exactly what you want. It might actually backfire, because we actually have a couple swings at the bat before it, or a bite to the apple, or however you want to say it. But we have, as a metro member, we have different chances. The hunting and fishing part of it is I'm just not sure. Maybe our staff can explain how this exactly works. But my understanding is that the hunting and fishing, there is actually an exemption in the Constitution. So this was in the actual vote that went to the voters. Then it actually went, it's on the enacting language, I believe. But there is a way that they have to have a plan. So every project that receives this money all over the state has to do a plan. So it has to have what you're saying, the hunting and fishing and et cetera, a plan. So maybe Ms. Taylor can speak to some of that and how that works, or Mr. Johnson. Maybe I'll pass to him on this
question from Representative Magenius.
Well, I'm looking at your map.
Yep.
And your definition of metro is really metropolitan urbanizing area. And so that's not how anybody else defines metro, or at least anybody in our common lingo does not use that as metro. But I can look at the map and clearly see that there's been one LOHC project in Minneapolis and all of its inner ring suburbs. One. That does not seem, that is not right. I won't say it doesn't seem to be right. It is not right. So that's one of the issues, if I could.
Representative Magenius.
If anybody wants me to explain the map a little bit better, I can do that. This is Lake Minnetonka in Hennepin County, and that's far out from Minneapolis and its first ring suburbs. But when we talk about the Constitution, I thought this would come up, so I brought a copy of the Constitution with me. And the way the Constitution reads, it's very clear. Land must be open to public taking of fish and game during the open season, but there's an unless otherwise provided by law.
Yep, that's why we are trying to reach out to staff.
So if we provide otherwise, okay. It is unless otherwise provided by law. So if we put it in law, you don't have to have hunting and fishing. You don't have to have hunting and fishing. It's very clear.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, two things. First of all, I'll hit the second one first. Unless otherwise provided by law is correct. And that's the way the council looks at it as well. So with regards to CPL or with regards to the small grants and the Conservation Partner Legacy grants or the larger grants, we look to statute as well as constitutional amendment. Both have that wording. The only change is in statute. It says unless otherwise provided by state law. But right in here, the language in this bill currently says unless otherwise provided by law. So if it's in a, you know, if there's a public ordinance, if there's a reason for not having hunting and fishing, whether it's in the metro or outstate,
That's something that's taken into consideration in the process, and the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources signs off on every one of those grants. So it's always taken into consideration that hunting or fishing, whether it's going to be allowed, whether it's not going to be allowed, and if not, why. The other question was regarding the map, and these are just completed projects within the metro as of January 15th, so there's still ongoing work. The other thing is that I keep reiterating, we're kind of at the mercy of the projects that come in, and I always want to reach out to you all, to each one of the watershed districts and the cities and whoever, saying, if you have projects or if you have ideas or if you just want have an idea, want to bounce off us and say, where's the right place for us to go for funding? Is it OHF or someplace else? We are really open to that. We don't want to turn anybody away. We want to make sure everybody gets a bite of the apple or a chance at least to swing. And to your points, ma'am.
Representative McGinnis.
Well, the history is such that folks expect they cannot get money from LOHC, so they don't apply. So if we are going to have applications from areas that have traditionally not gotten the money, we're going to have to tell them it is open for them to get money.
Representative.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Wiginius, the CPL grants, just so everybody knows, I mean, they really it's really an effort that we've made, I think, in the last couple of years, and to improve kind of the scenario, to move some of these projects into the metro, to do smaller grants, to have access to that. So we've greatly increased the fund, I think, during the last couple of years, and I think it's now up to $10 million. And these are going to smaller groups all over the state, including the metro. So, but the map, you know, that it appears here, I have argued some of what you're saying is the map is some of these counties are actually big, you know, that Washington County or Dakota County actually goes pretty far south, or Washington County, sure, you know, so some of these are definitely a stretch to the metro in my mind, and has been, and this will be Representative Finn's new fight when she takes over, and good luck with that. So I'm not totally against the amendment. I just the reality is, I don't think across the street you're going to have much luck. But you know, that doesn't mean that we should be stopped and having discussions on this. But I think I think there really is an effort to try to make this accessible or whatever to something that the metro can try to get these grants. And we have. I think there is some perception that they can't get the money. And, I had a problem with LCCMR where one of my counties, Washington County, didn't get a grant, and I found out. But it was, you know, there was some politics that was played, too, in that. And they're really, so they didn't get it. Some other projects were picked. But there isn't politics played with it. This is out of the political hand. The DNR, these have to be good projects that get these grants. You know, it's not first come in there to get the money. It's they've got to be good, and that's all over the state. So they can't just, even in the metro pie or if they go statewide, they've got to be good. And actually, it's an advantage to have the structure with the $3 million in a way. It was brought to my attention because we get the first bite of that. They don't have to be the best projects in the state. They just have to be the best in the metro to get the money. They may not live up to a standard that's, you know, a statewide. Anyways,
so just to give my purpose here on page on 20.7, 20.8, 20.9, the requirement to say that it, as unless provided by law, when we provide this in session law, then we're restricting the access. By removing the language in the amendment, then you're not restricting the access. And so I think there is anecdotal evidence of people not applying anymore. Applying because of those requirements. And so you may be able to get fishing but not hunting, or you may be able to get hunting but not fishing. And so that provision to remove the unless provided by law, when we have that boilerplate, for lack of a better term, the boilerplate language in there, then you're providing it in law that puts the restriction on. In addition, I understand the natural area of trying to have connectivity in there, but it also makes it very hard to have connectivity if there's nothing connecting in the center of the urbanizing area. And that could be Rochester or Duluth, or it could be St. Cloud, or it could be Moorhead as well. So what I'm trying to do here is I'm not changing any other appropriations, just the CPL grant, because I think the de facto situation here is it has a screening impact, and that screening impact then impacts everyone. So there's nothing in the constitutional language that says it does not apply in the metro area. Everybody applies to everybody. And so I'm asking, you know, let's try this and see if it does change things. That was the beauty of the Outdoor Heritage Council being on annual appropriations, because then you can be flexible on changing things, unlike the clean water appropriations be every 2 years, parks and trails every 2 years, arts and history every 2 years, that the ability to meet and change and be flexible is part of the annual appropriation. So that's my purpose for the amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lilly.
Just briefly, it seems to me that just by talking to Mr. Johnson here, I think there's statute that could probably apply from I think his conversation with Chair Anderson, they're probably okay with the hunting and fishing thing, you know, that you're talking about, and within the range, you know, of that, because I think those are kind of workable or very workable, but I'm just not sure that you're being exactly, and I'm sorry I wasn't more clear on that, but on the grants, I think your intent might not actually do what you're hoping to do. So,
Representative Lee, you're talking about the $3 million?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Representative Fabian.
I think I'll defer to Mr. Johnson right now. Director Johnson, come back to me if you don't mind.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, with regards to the $3 million, Representative Lilly was correct that, or Chair Lilly was correct that the $3 million comes right off the top for the metro area, and it's only for the 7-county metro, as it states in the bill. It's not the whole urbanizing area or the 11-county metro. So the 7-county metro gets an extra chomp at that apple right up front, and then of the remaining $8 million in that appropriation, they can if there are any more, they can apply for all of that. So it's a double bite right now. Your language, unfortunately, Mr. Chair, I think would reduce it to a single bite.
President Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's what I wanted to talk about, too. We, as a council, I've been on the council for 2 years, and one of my main objectives has been to get more money into the CPL program. This is one of the best things that we have going. And we've had conversations in the council meetings about, let's get more money into the metro area and let's try to do a better job of doing this, and the council agrees. I've asked Mr. Hagemeyer to go through what we've got just so far this year coming from the CPL grants, and it will shed some light on what's actually going on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, I had to pull this together kind of quickly. It came from the DNR's website on FY 2019 awards to the CPL program so far, and what they had produced, and I'm not sure what date this was last published. The traditional grant program through the CPL provided $4.6 million of grants. The metro grants were approximately $3.6 million in FY 19. I should mention one of those was not the core metro area here. One was in the Duluth area, I believe. And the CPL program is the one that are under the expedited program that are under $50,000. There's about $1.65 million of grants so far. In total, those do not equal the sum that was appropriated last year, so I'm thinking there's still some money out there that can be done. So that's up to date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with due respect, Mr. Chair, I think you could have helped yourself out a lot here if you'd had some conversations with some of us earlier rather than bringing this to the committee when we're under a big time crunch here. And
Representative Fabian, so I was just about to encourage working with Representative Lilly here to actually take the $3 million out if you're okay with the other language, and then we can move this bill. That's okay. Representative Fabian.
But then, Mr. Chair, process and procedure and so forth in committee, I mean, now that's becoming a substantial change to your amendment.
Actually, Mr. Representative Fabian, Representative Lilly can take that out in his committee because that's where it's going, so that we would pass this out here. It goes to Representative Lilly. He takes it out. He has the jurisdiction here. We're in open committee. We're having the discussion, and that would be what we would encourage to do.
So final point, I would be more comfortable if we just don't do your amendment today, and then you continue having some conversations about it. I'm not in favor of this. We've discussed this several times in the commission and the council, and these are the council recommendations, and I don't really want to get into this conversation, but we're going to be now be going against the recommendations of the council. And, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask for a roll call on your amendment.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple things. So it's the land acquired in fee must be open to hunting and fishing during the open season. The language itself is not necessarily problematic because it is the same as the constitutional amendment. What's problematic is it's interesting to me that why would you repeat something that's already in the Constitution just in the section that has any impact on metro projects? And so I think that piece of it is telling as to the confusion folks seem to have on legally what the Constitution actually says. Because I don't think, and I mean, my legal reading is the unless, if the idea was it must be open to public taking of fish and game during the open season, period, then that would be what it says. You look at you read it on the face of it, what does that language mean? And so the fact that the unless otherwise provided by law, I think has really been confused by a lot of folks and then repeated over and over and over again, so that the message that folks in the community are getting and that potential projects are getting is, oh, everybody on the council thinks that means it has to be open for hunting and fishing. And then, so we can speak to the number of projects that applied, but you're not going to know who was headed off at the pass before they even bothered doing the work to apply, because it's been repeated so many times that, oh, nope, you can't hunt and fish there, so, you know, that's just going to be a waste of your time. And so I think it's really important that the public realizes that these dollars were meant for everybody, and regardless of where you live in the state. And so I think that piece is really important. And so I think I am really glad to see this taken out, just because I think it's perpetuating this myth that you have to be able to hunt and fish. And as to the hunting and fishing, et cetera, there is no et cetera. There's no constitutional right to trap. There's no it's taking of game and fish. And so I think, you know, I always go back to Constitution. Anyone who's even served with me in the last 2 years, that's you have to go back and look at what the Constitution actually says. So I'm really happy to see this taken out, because I think it sets aside this confusion that people seem to have about this issue. And, you know, and that's not to say that, you know, there necessarily was bad intent by folks in perpetuating that myth, but it's a myth. That's not what the Constitution says. You know, as someone who's looking forward to getting to work on the council, I would like to see us looking at the council at the applications and the projects based on their merit and what they're doing to promote folks getting access to the outdoors and you know, doing what you're supposed to be doing and protecting habitat for game, fish, and wildlife. Last night I spoke with Representative Lee. There are hundreds of kids in his district who live within feet of the Mississippi River, and they don't have access. And maybe there are great projects out there, but nobody's applying because they think that everybody in Minneapolis shouldn't even bother. And so I want to make sure that that's really clear. You know, and I think overall, you know, the CPL projects, they're in phase 11. I think I would tend to trust that they know what they're doing in picking good projects without us putting additional limitations on their ability to do that. So I'm in favor of this amendment. I don't like the idea of limiting anything based on whether you call it metro or urban or suburban or rural or whatever it is. We're all Minnesotans. We should all have access to the dollars in this account, in these funds. And so I'm in support of the amendment and am glad to have the discussion here today.
Mr. Chair.
President Fagan.
Just real quickly, the myth that's being perpetuated is not reflected in the dollars being spent. We just heard it from Mr. Hagemeyer. So, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I can respond.
Representative Fabian. Representative Griffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The myth is that it has to be land where you can hunt and fish. I'm not speaking to the whatever definition of whatever you're pointing to. What I've heard from folks and what has been repeated to me is that, well, the council won't approve anything where you know they don't like projects because they think that it means it has to be land where you can hunt and fish. And so that's the myth. The myth is that it has to be land where you have to be able to hunt and fish, and that is not what the Constitution says. And so I hope people are listening and that the public is hearing this, because that the Constitution allows you to apply just like anybody else. And then I would hope that the council would do the work to decide whether that's a good project on its merits or not, regardless of that. You know, obviously I hunt, I fish, I want to see more folks doing that, but the myth is that if we're acquiring land and fee, that it has to be able to be used for hunting and fishing, and by de facto ruling out a lot of places. And that's the myth. People need to apply. You all have access to apply to these funds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually welcome all this discussion, and I just think it's one of the neatest things that's going on around here at the Capitol. And a lot of it is really, you'd be surprised, it's very conservation driven, so around the state. And yes, if you fix up a prairie, if you fix up a wetland, if you fix up a stream, there's going to be more things to hunt and fish. But it's a kind of a weird marriage of this hunting groups and fishing, but there's a lot of conservation with the conservation groups too. But it's just this amazing a marriage. But the conservation grants, the CPL, really was intent on trying to get it into smaller, some of the smaller groups as well. Representative Fabian mentions some local groups up in his area, but we're trying to, I mean, that the intent was really pure on that, to really do some smaller projects and to get it in the metro. And there's a lot of talk about trying to get folks in the metro to participate, because the reality is many of the hunting groups are getting smaller and smaller in the traditional sense. So, I mean, making a big mistake by not reaching out to newer groups that are very interested in sports activities, whether that's hunting and fishing and beyond that, but trying to get them outside. So I don't know that I – that's not really to the amendment, but it's I don't mind the discussion. It's it's, and I know Representative Hansen, you were very active on this committee, and Representative Fabian, but it's neat to have Chair Wagenius's perspective, because you two were very integral in creating this thing. I might have created it differently myself. You know, maybe a little bit more money for parks and trails, I hate to say. I shouldn't say that with you here. But, you know, I think that's the future, maybe, is a little bit. But I don't know that I would have included this language. But there's a lot of neat conservation work. And it's sad because I wish we had a longer time to discuss this, because this package, there's some really neat stuff. And you're going to, when you get on here, you're going to realize that it was a 12-0 vote. But we fight and we talk about it, and you win some fights and you lose. But there's a lot of neat things that are going on. So, anyways, I don't mind the discussion.
So just where we're at, I'd like to vote on the amendment and move the bill out if we can. And then, mm-hmm. Representative Lilly, it's in your hands, and you would have the ability to amend in your committee. So we wouldn't be doing an amendment to the amendment here. I know, Representative Green, you'd raised your hand, but are you okay if we move forward? And
that's fine. We can, Mr. Chair, but just for clarification, I kind of read that a little differently. Because on line 20.7 down to 20.9, it looks to me like you're taking out the language that says unless provided by law. And in the discussion that I'm hearing here, it sounds like you're you're only referring to the legacy law. But when I read it, I thought if, let's say, in Hennepin County, they had a law that says you can't hunt with a rifle in Hennepin County, and now it looks like you're taking that away. But you guys, you know, you're doing a good job beating up on each other, so I'll just let you go ahead and do that.
So a roll call has been asked for. Renew my motion for the amendment.
This is a roll call vote on Amendment A2. Hansen.
Yes.
Claflin.
Yes.
Fabian.
No.
Backer. Becker Finn.
Yes.
Eklund.
No.
Fisher.
Yes.
Green.
No.
Heintzman. Lee.
Yes.
Lewick.
No.
Morrison.
Yes.
New. Purcell. Sandell.
Yes.
Sundin.
Yes.
Wagenius.
Yes.
Nine yeses, four nays. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lee, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, thank you for providing the maps of the different projects over here. And, you know, having seen this, I do share the concerns that Representative Wagenius brought up, too. And even though my district is located in the city of Minneapolis, if members around the committee, you know, actually visit my district, we are not really reflective of the city of Minneapolis as a whole. And my district is probably the most demographically diverse district in the state of Minnesota. And it is disturbing to see that none of the projects are located near my district. And so, Mr. Johnson, I want to ask you, can you provide members of the committee, you know, just the breakdown or the of the different projects? Are they being led by organizations that are reflective of the community? Are they organizations of color or from indigenous organizations? And do you have a breakdown of if any of these organizations and projects are led by women, veterans, or people with disability? And if you could provide that information.
Mr. Johnson, I assume you're going to get back.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, I don't know that information. I can get to DNR and see if they have that. They're in charge of the CPL grants. As far as some of the larger grants, we have the names of those, the organizations, but I don't believe any of them are specifically led by a person of color or female.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm really asking that so that we can start seeing, you know, all of these projects through a lens of equity to see how our communities of color and indigenous communities and, you know, women groups, how are they being able to access some of these funding? And, you know, just to say that just looking at this map again, we do have projects in Hennepin County, but how many of them are in Minneapolis or how many of them are in the surrounding suburbs? And it's not reflected on here. And so I really encourage you when you start looking at this project and when you're doing outreach to actually do the outreach out into communities like mine. And like I mentioned to you in our conversation in my office, that oftentimes people in my community, they self-select themselves out. And to the point that Representative Becker Finn mentioned about the during the discussion about the amendment, when people read and see some of these languages that we have in the application or what we have in statute, people self-select themselves out of even applying. And I don't think that that's fair for the people of my district, the people of the district around the metro region, and to the people of the state of Minnesota. And so when we think about this, how could we think about this through an equity lens so that we can actually encourage people to apply? And as one of our state agencies, I asked you to really think about the process that you have in place in reaching out to communities. And it's not just, you know, Representative Lee being from a different community, so what can Representative Lee bring to the table? You're one of the state agencies. Your responsibility is to the public and to the state of Minnesota. And so I implore you to really look at the processes that you have in place to really reach out to our communities who are underserved or who may not know about this. And just one last point, you know, for myself, I'm sitting at the table today as one of our, you know, members of the Minnesota House of Representatives. But before I got here, I did not even know that this exists. And so that's, you know, the seriousness of this this problem, this issue. If I, as a member of the Minnesota House, did not know about this before I got here, think about the community members that I have in my district. And so going forward, I really want you to start thinking about this and really see how could we get all community members here in the state of Minnesota to be able to access some of these funds. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jim Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really value your comments. And one of the things that we've struggled with is there's a debate that goes on with these funds, too, about buying public land. And part of it is some of the communities that you're speaking about can't necessarily afford public lands. So by this constitutional amendment, folks have been able to get access to much more public land. And they are, you know, and they're out hunting, and you may not know that it's necessarily like legacy dollars or LCCMR dollars or even general fund DNR dollars or something. So, but no, to your point, it can be done much better. We, in the metro, you have an amazing park system, and so it's, you know, I mean, you're not going to be able to do certain things, but getting access to the river, I know it's been a priority for Minneapolis the last few years, and so that's done historically more through parks. And then instead of like, but those parks are including like islands that have fishing piers on them and those sort of things. So we're trying to, I know that they're listening, but I'm glad you, I definitely support. We did buy, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. With, there was a couple years ago, we did work with the Fond du Lac.
Yep.
And so there was some effort with that. And there's quite a few women that are on the board right now. And there was an African American lady, right? And then, no, that was LCCMR. I'm sorry, but no, we always can do better. And I'm glad that you said what you said. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Representative Lilly, and I know that both caucuses have to meet in about 5 minutes. So, Representative McGinnis, if we can,
I'll just have one. Yeah. I would just observe that you may not be buying land in Minneapolis and the First Ring Suburbs. There is huge opportunity for restoration. Right. And yep. Within that opportunity, we should be doing carbon sequestration, which also is an issue I haven't brought up to the council, but we've got to have a conversation about that, and we can do that in your committee.
I renew my motion that House File 340, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommended referral to the Legacy Division. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. No. Ayes have it. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We are adjourned.